Hey, my name is David Marquet, and I'm here on the Agile Uprising podcast. Welcome all you listeners out there. My superpower? Well, I used to be a submarine commander, which is pretty cool, but now I'm a consultant. So my superpower is to make a 2x2 matrix out of anything. You can test me. Send me an email and say, here's something complicated. Let me do something with that. Let's get started, Andy. Have some fun.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Andy Clef, and my special co-host today is Eric Cottrell, CEO of Agile Velocity and fellow fanboy of our guest. Welcome, Eric. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're both delighted to be chatting with David Marquet. Welcome back. It's hard to believe it's been 2 years since we last have you on the show.
Shocking.
And neither of us has aged at all. When we last talked, we spoke about your book, Turn the Ship Around, and you told the story of abandoning your command and control leadership training as the commander of a nuclear-powered fast attack submarine. And you wrote that you did this to solve two small problems you had on the boat, the fleet's worst morale and the fleet's worst performance.
Yeah.
You described in that book the changes you experimented with over, I don't know, a year, year and a half, that resulted in the amazing transformation from the worst boat to the Navy's top performer. And what's even more amazing is that transformation stuck. 10 years later, the Santa Fe continued to outperform her peers. You have a new book, Leadership is Language, launching in February 4th, where you give business people the tools that they need to achieve similar transformational leadership. Why this book now?
This book, it started as a whole list of don't say this, say that. At a very tactical level. So we were interacting with companies and we said, well, don't say, is it safe? Will it work? Is that assumption true? But how safe is it? How likely is it to work? Don't say they didn't do this for me. Say we didn't do it. And so we had all these sort of little mantras, but they were very hard to remember. And so that was happening at a tactical. You can't just remember a big list. So that's at the tactical. At the same time, I was giving a bunch of speeches at Agile events, and I was enamored of the approach. And there's this parallel on the submarine. What I was trying to do was get thinking to happen. My problem was both of those. All my problems stem from the same root cause, which was a lack of thinking by everybody. This organization was designed so that a few people at the top did the thinking and everyone else at the bottom did the doing. And this dichotomy wasn't going to help me. And so when I saw Agile, which just roughly in my gross interpretation is, hey, we're going to think a little bit. We're going to do a sprint planning. And then the team is going to decide what to do. In other words, the doers will be this side. And then we're going to go head down into doing. And we're going to not protect the team from whipsaw, from the good idea fairy. And then we're going to raise our heads up at the end of the sprint, and we're going to reflect upon what we did. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is the first time I've ever heard anything that resembled what I think we were trying to do. And so it was just reflective back to me. So this book, don't tell anyone, it's basically a hijack of Agile in a leadership space, but written at the tactical level. What does it sound like if I were to run meetings at Boeing at the most senior level using this approach to life and work?
You know, one of the things that I love about this book is the connection you make to the old school leadership paradigms, how language was so programmed into us from the Industrial Revolution age, right? Where, and you mentioned it, there's the doers and the thinkers and that segmentation. And it sort of leads to the question of what do we expect from our leaders anyway, as we emerge from the Industrial Revolution? And why do some leaders still hang on to that old style of language?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is, first of all, I feel we're programmed in a sense to speak and react and respond in different ways. If someone comes up to you, I can almost predict if I'm in a business meeting and someone says, hey, I got some bad news. I don't think we should launch the product next week like we were scheduled to. I can almost predict how people will respond. They'll react, they'll reply, they'll respond, they'll defend their position. At the best, they may say, well, why would you think that? Which again is kind of provocative and puts the person on the defensive. What I rarely see is a curiosity about what they see and what they think that the rest of us may be missing. And this is what we're trying to get at. But I think it's not because we're evil. I think it's just because we've been programmed to respond like this. And this programming just kind of gets passed from generation to generation.
There's that great experiment by Milgram where it seemed to show that humans were so willing to abdicate responsibility and just comply. And is that some of the legacy?
Yeah. Comply is one of the industrial age plays. So what I think happened, so I was trying to figure out the whole magic is how do you structure a whole group of ideas in my mind. And so I settled on this playbook idea. And because I was sitting there on the airplane, I got on the airplane, I was flying out of San Francisco to Tampa. Guy sits down next to me. He has his duffel bag. He throws his big book on the out. And I look over, and it's like a football playbook. And I said, is that a playbook? He said, yeah. It's like, wow, tell me about it. Blah, blah, blah. And he's going on and on and on. I go, are you somehow associated with football? He goes, yeah, I'm the head coach for the Oakland Raiders.
There you go. Serendipity.
Yeah. It was John Gruden, who had just gotten hired back, like a 10-year, $100 million contract or something. And I asked him, so he's showing them to me. Now, he doesn't know me from Adam, so he's very open and generous to do this. And for all the plays, the first whole half of the thing is nothing to do with football.
Right.
They're all about how to act in the locker room, how to act on the practice field, how to act at home. And I said, well, tell me about this. And the first words out of his mouth were, it's all about language. And as soon as he said that, I said, that's a sign from the heavens. It's a playbook. And that's how I think about it. So comply and conform are two of the industrial age plays. That's what we want. If you have an organization where one group of people is making the decisions for the other group of people, there has to be coercion, there has to be compliance, and it has to be conformity. It just has to be part of it. Now, we don't say that because it's kind of ugly. So we say motivation or inspiration, but that's basically what it is.
Yeah, one of our board members on the Agile Uprising, Jay, shared an article, and I'll put a link in the show notes. It's from the Boston Review, and it was a eureka moment for him and the rest of us too. It was about Taylor and Gantt, and how the management practices that came from Taylorism and Gantt are directly tied to plantation history and management of the plantation, i.e. slavery, optimization of resources, command and control, compliance. And so if we're to ditch that old playbook and move and change mindsets, like you did on the Santa Fe, what did you do to your internal operating system? Where did you start? And then we can dive into the details of some of the new plays.
Yeah. So I'm going to plus one what you just said. There's a great book called Accounting for Slavery by Caitlin Rosenthal. And in it, she traces the modern accounting system to the same basic plantation economy. And it was a real eye opener for me as well. But you got to reprogram yourself is the answer to the question. And reprogramming yourself is one of the hardest things for humans to do. You're building new habits. For me, I just started with just sentence starters. And so, for example, one of the things I needed to learn in this new way of doing business was how to be vulnerable and how to create an opening for people to question the orders that, if I had to give them, what I would say. So instead of saying, drive the ship, like what you see in the movie, drive here, the enemy's here,
right,
and then we'll do this. I would say, well, first of all, they'd be coming to me saying, hey, I intend to drive over here. And I said, okay, what's that based on? Well, it's based on the following assumption. I said, all right, great. What worries me about that is what if the enemy isn't over there? What if they're actually in this other direction? And so I had to build sentence starters like what worries me or what I'm thinking right now or those kind of things, which were very unnatural based on my leadership training.
So, David, when you were in that position, you had an impetus, right? You had a reason for changing the way that you had behaved and had been trained, prepared really, to lead. So what's changed at a macro level that says we should change the way that we talk, that culture requires a different approach? What do you think is happening that people should really take stock of?
So there's a couple things. In this old world of thinking and doing, I label those so that they can become personas. So thinking is doing, is we call that blue work.
Okay.
Thinking work, creative, broad perspective, benefits from variability. Then there's focused doing, production work. Variability is an enemy to that work. So think manufacturing. You want every drill hole the same, spaced out evenly, blah, blah, blah. So what's changing is as machines and algorithms are taking more and more and more of the doing work, the organizations that will win are the ones that can use humans to the thing that humans are really good at, which is the thinking part. Humans are not particularly good at doing simple, repetitive physical tasks repeatedly for 8.5 hours a day. They suck at that.
Right.
So that's why we had to brainwash them with a certain education program and beat the creativity out of them. But that's a whole other story. In any event, so what's happening is organizations that want to win in the future are going to be ones that treat their human employees as humans and optimize the work in a way that humans are all the humans, not just like the 10 people at the top, but everybody in the organization is periodically a thinker. The problem isn't doing and thinking. The problem is dividing your organization into doers and thinkers. You want everyone to be a thinker. So the phrase we use is let the doers be the deciders.
That's a radical concept, right?
It's agile.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. It's definitely an uprising type of a topic, right? So, yeah. I mean, I think when I reflect back on Turn the Ship Around, you basically say, look, I have a whole organization. I have their hearts and their minds, right, dedicated to solving these problems. It's a tidal wave of power and mindset and thinking and creativity and energy. And I think this book begins to turn the corner into now, okay, how do we do this day to day, right? Like, what words do I use that really are revolutionary versus, you know, the industrial playbook, which has thousands and thousands and thousands of books, and things did work, right? So there's this history and this inertia. And now you're saying, okay, look, in the modern age, in the new world, things have changed. And so we need to change how we talk. I think that's powerful.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, precisely. And it is so seductive because at the time it did work. And I dedicate some pages to Taylor. Taylor is quoted as saying, we don't actually want the people to think. You see, in Taylor's world, we the leaders, and I'm gonna say something potentially uncomfortable. But we divided the world into two, the thinkers and the doers. And the thinkers were the ones who went to college and we called them management. And then they were salaried people. And then we had the doers who were hourly, unionized, blue collar, whatever. And we had these cultural labels. It was a caste system. And I think that some of what we're seeing in the political world now is a legacy of this idea that no, we get to make all the decisions, you just do what you're told and pat, pat, pat on the head. But obviously all the humans are all equally intelligent just because we mistake education for intelligence and say, oh, well, I went to college, you didn't, so I must be smarter than you. Wrong. I'm not an expert on this, but I've been musing about it recently. But the whole point is you gotta let the doers be the deciders, and it doesn't work otherwise, because humans will not be at their best doing something that they were told to do. They'll be at their best when they're doing something that they themselves committed to.
There's also the cycle time involved in going up the ladder to get confirmation and coming back down. And by the time that's happened, the situation has changed and the answer is no longer relevant. So, you know, the other thing, back to your question, Eric, why today? It's the stock answer. We live in a VUCA world where things are complex and changing and getting more and more complex more quickly. So long-term, not only prosperity, but survival needs adaptation more than just simply getting shit done and achieving.
GSD.
GSD.
Yeah, exactly. And so what the phrase we use is, don't push information to authority. That was the industrial age approach. All hierarchies have the same condition, which is they've separated the people who know what's going on, who live at the periphery of the organization, from the people with the authority who live at the center of the organization. And so this traditional approach is take the information, aggregate it, send it to the middle. We'll buy some software that can do that for us. We say push the authority for making decisions to the people who natively have the information, and that will reduce the cycle time because, oh, I have the information, I make the decision, not I have the information, now I got to pause. I was at a hotel, I checked in, and they were supposed to pick me up with their shuttle, and they didn't. And so it's late at night, and I show up, and the clerk's apologetic, and he knows he kind of did me wrong, and I'm staying there for like 4 days. So, and he says, oh, I'll send an email to the manager. And then the next day, 24 hours later, I get a note. We're so sorry, Mr. Marquet. You have free breakfast for the rest of your day. I don't care. It's too late. What is so magic that the clerk couldn't have figured? I'm sure he could have. And he could see the pain in his face when he had to say, well, listen, and he could tell. Is it not the greatest place to work in America?
And right.
Do this over and over again to our people.
Doer, not a decider. Instead, how would you have liked it to have happened, David? If that clerk happens to be listening, the one in 5 billion chance yeah. that clerk he or she is listening to this podcast, how would you like it to have been?
First of all, it's not their fault. That's the first thing we want to be clear about. It's leadership set up a system that didn't let that person make decisions. But what leadership should have said, look, you take care of the customer. Your job is to take care of the customer. The clerk would have said, hey, breakfast is on us. Right then and there, boom, it would have mitigated it. And then an email, that this is what I did. Or he could have said, maybe, I intend to give this person free breakfast. But even that kind of has a delay built into it. Yeah. For bigger things, you might want to do that. But in this case, like, what is so scary about that? The person is the only overnight, can manage the hotel overnight, but for some reason can't give away free breakfast. Makes no sense.
Makes no sense. It really does. And that is not entrusting people with the authority and autonomy that they need. It's just treating them as meat widgets.
Right.
So I want to dive into the six new plays, the theme that you got on that serendipitous aircraft flight.
Yeah.
Part of for those who haven't read the book yet, I encourage you to get it. But it's framed in six basic plays that refactor our Industrial Revolution approach to leadership. You want to just list them out real quick, and then we'll dive in, and Eric and I can tag team back and forth.
Yeah. So first of all, let me tell you, so this is what I think is the clever part of the book, which I spent a lot of time sorting through. Let me tell you what I think the industrial age, what we programmed to do in the industrial age. Number one, obey the clock. That's why we have the word clockwork in the language. That's why we pay people by the hour. It's the sense of doing X units of work per time. Obey the clock. And because we've separated the doers from the deciders have to coerce the doers into doing something they didn't decide to do. Then the job of the doers is then to comply with what they've been told, with the goal of continuing production as long as possible, never interrupt the production run. And our mindset is one of proving and performing, getting stuff done. And then throughout it all, our cultural, the feeling in the hierarchical feeling is to conform to my role in the hierarchy. Don't be an uppity person. Don't try and challenge things. Just find your social place and just stay there. And what I think we want is to control the clock, not obey the clock. And that, which means, hey, time out. We got some time to think about this. If you don't relieve the pressure of the clock, you never can shift into a thinking mode. Then collaborate, not coerce. Then commit. So from collaboration, we get internal commitment with complete. And this is, again, you can see how it's parallel. Some people might say lifted from, but agile. But we're going to do the work in chunks that allow us to celebrate and then reflect back When Ford started making Model Ts, he made the same car for over 15 years, from 1904 into the 20s. But by this time, everything had changed, and he was still making Model Ts. With the mindset of improve, not prove, it's the learning game. And then the final thing is, underneath it all, instead of conforming to our hierarchical roles, we've got to connect as human beings. Human connection allows us to have healthy emotions. Healthy emotions are necessary for healthy decision-making. Now, we didn't care about that in the industrial age, so I didn't need everyone to make decisions, so I didn't care about their emotional health.
Right.
But now I do. So this is why I go to work, I'm a stuffed shirt, I don't really bring my true self to work, and I conform. I'm the CEO, you're the whatever. That's all a manifestation of this idea that why would I get to know you? My job is to coerce you into doing something that I want you to do.
Yeah, personal connections hinder that.
Correct. So it's conform or connect. The final play is connect, yeah. That you want. You want to connect as a human.
Eric, you want to dive into the first one, talking about the clock?
So this is certainly one of the pressure points that leadership does feel. Right? The clock is the thing and horizons are shortened, right? So when you're looking at decision points and giving your people the tools they need to hit pause, right? That's something that's going to have to change, because right now everything that we do seems to be on a quarterly basis, if not, you know, shorter than that. So the horizon's very, very narrow. So, you know, how do we give people the tools to hit pause on a plan of action if they notice that something is wrong, right? That is a very different mindset. Is how do we pull the chain and say, we need to evaluate that? What do you recommend in that case if somebody sees something?
So a couple of things, like the Andon cord in the Toyota production system is a perfect example. This is exactly the purpose of it. You're in production mode. You're in doing mode. You're on the line, but then there's a problem. You need to send a signal. I got a problem and I need to shift out of production mode into thinking and problem solving mode. And this is what Andon is, the Japanese word for lantern. It's a signal. And so we need to give our people a way to signal that, and then we need to be attuned to it. Now there's a little bit of a trick here, or there's a pitfall, I guess. If you make it easier for people to exit the performance doing and go to pause and think, but you don't make it also easier to go from pause and think back to perform and do, then what you'll do is you'll end up over-biased into pause and think, which no one's going to like. So we also need to make it easier to go back into. And this, again, is what I think, thinking about the word work in short chunks. Okay, now we've paused. Okay, here's an idea. Okay, let's go try it. Well, we could sit there and, well, is it the very best idea? Well, I don't know. We could spend 2 hours talking about it. But I know this is better than what we're doing right now, so let's go try it. And then think of the work in these short chunks. But it's giving it a name, like what are you going to call it, giving people a tool, and then practicing it. It's not enough to just say, oh, everyone has the ability to stop the procedure. I've seen this too in medical operating units, or you're about to fly an airplane. Everyone has the ability to raise their hand. But no one does,
right.
And we never practice it because all those cultural inhibitions.
Power differentials, right? Even in the cockpit, even in the operating room, right?
Yeah.
There's that power differential.
Yeah, power differential. We call it the power gradient. It's how much more important your boss is than you. It affects, you don't speak up against the boss. Information flows inversely proportional to the power gradient. So the steeper the power gradient is. So we got these I work with this global company in Switzerland, and you can tell when you're getting near the CEO because the carpet gets thicker, the rooms get quiet. I mean, literally the carpet is thicker. Yep. And I'm just laughing. And people are, when they want to go from one side of the building, they actually go down a floor, cross over, and there's no official prohibition. But and then the executives are like, oh, well, we didn't know. No one told us. Yeah, because you made yourselves inaccessible. That's your fault.
Yeah.
What?
You know, so you had mentioned Agile and some of the frameworks there. So some of the controlling the clock is built into things like Scrum and SAFe, right? With the cycles.
I love it. Yes, exactly. It's a predetermined stop point. We're going to go for 2 weeks, three, whatever it is, and then we're going to stop deliberately. So you don't need to worry about the stop point. You just focus all of your cognitive energy on doing this, and you can throw yourself fully into the work because you know how far off track can you get in 2 weeks? We're going to reevaluate it. That's much better than, oh, you're going to go do this forever, but we may be way off track in 6 months. And then so you're worried about that. So you're not really into the work. So you're neither into the work or out of the work. You're just sort of halfway in the work, and that's no good.
We give that pause a name, retrospective. And it's one of the most powerful ceremonies, I think, in the Scrum tradition.
And I also think it's one that's often jettisoned. So I think that when we interact with clients, when we look at what they're doing, we ask, do you have time to pause? Because it's hard to pause, right? This clock is always ticking and that's always there. And so I think by saying, hey, we have this thing and are we doing it? And are we throwing ourselves into really learning in this window? And it's powerful, but I don't know, Andy, you see it too, right?
Yeah, but I'll toss this out to both of you gentlemen. What is the system, what in the systems causing that? That means every system perfectly designed to get the results it gets. And when you yank out the pause, you're going to keep getting what you got. So what's the pressure to not pause and improve? Where does that come from? What's the incentive?
Well, I don't know about the incentive, but I think the rationale is I must be right. I don't really need people questioning what we're doing. Just do it. Then, of course, you're out of business 2 years later because you're renting DVDs in the market someplace, something like that. But I mean, there is an urgency. Done right, this will allow you to do more and make better decisions. It's not, to my mind, a trade-off. The idea is when we're in decision-making, we want to have a super broad perspective. But when we're in doing mode, we want to have a super narrow focus. It's not, I want to be halfway focused all the time. This is not the way to be. You will be neither good at production work nor good at thinking work.
Yeah.
And this is, and if you don't have a language, like this is one of the brilliant things about Agile. It gives us a language to say, okay, am I in perspective? Is this when I can cast a wide net and look left and right, have a head up? Am I in that mode? Or I'm like, no, just code for 2 weeks. Take your headphones off in 2 weeks.
I think the red-blue delineation is actually brilliant because I know that people do get confused, like, oh, do we stop here or do we, they don't, it's not crystal clear. Look, we are right now, we're running, we're blue, we're executing, going to have time for, or we're red, we're going to go to blue, but let's go get it done and let's learn.
Right now, this is one of the things about Santa Fe that people couldn't understand. We were in our meetings, we were better at getting dissenting opinions out on the table. And so we made stronger decisions, but we were also better when it came time, okay, start the reactor. This is the procedure. We were better at following that with precision than the other submarine. People couldn't understand. Well, I thought this was about doing what you want. And I said, no, you don't get it. It's about, it's really about just identifying, am I in broad perspective mode, head up.
Right.
I do some open water swims, and you do the exact same thing. Your head's down, you're swimming. You can be swimming straight.
Yeah.
But I don't, there's no lane line. So you start swimming off course. So every once in a while you can stick your head up. But of course, when you stick your head up, you're not very hydrodynamic, and your hips sink, right. Yeah, so Eric's nodding, so you must be doing this too. And then, and so if you put your head up every three strokes, that's probably too much. But if you don't do it for every half an hour, that's probably, so the whole thing is like, how many strokes do I take before I stop and take a look? And if you get, if you become a better swimmer, you can go further. But that rhythm, managing that rhythm is what is the real secret. And that's the perfect analogy for work.
I think it's brilliant. And it's also, don't take a breath when you sight. You learn all of these things as you go along, right? So I think that's exactly it, which is we have to learn. We have to get better. And we have to jump into this blue mode of being able to widen our aperture and to accept. And here's the other thing. The thing I loved about your first book, Turn the Ship Around, was you were completely honest about where things went wrong. And I was like, oh, man. This guy's gonna just tell me how he had all figured out, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, and I'm like, it's the proverbial, like somebody's walking along the dock and they kick some cord and it unplugs the whole thing. And I was just like, holy crap, that is a whole level of vulnerability. So I think the blue for me, and you know, as I work with leadership, a lot of times that notion of vulnerability comes to bear. And I think that comes out in your new book a lot, which is not only, okay, it's one thing to acknowledge, okay, I need to be more vulnerable now, but they asked, how do I do that?
Yeah.
And I think this is a framework, and the clock, certainly being the clock, but also collaborating versus coercing, right? Is the way that we exhibit our vulnerability doesn't have to be, I'm going to tell you about my story when I was a child, but it can be, hey, I'm going to invite you into this problem. So yeah. I'm curious about that in terms of what you see in terms of collaborating versus coercing now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so a whole bunch of things. So people get together and say, well, here, we're in a meeting to build consensus. Now, what does that sound like? Embracing variability or reducing variability? Well, obviously building consensus means reducing variability. So this is a red work construct. It's about, so don't pretend that this is a decision meeting.
Right.
The decision's been made, you gotta get on board. But let's just say that. The reason we have these meetings, by the way, is so that the leader can later say, well, you guys were there, you guys all voted.
You didn't object.
Plausible deniability.
Yeah, exactly. I gave you a chance to raise your hand. No one told me 737 Mac software was no good.
That's too anyway. Soon, Dan. Too soon for that.
Too, yeah.
You know, but I'm reminding, and I think you mentioned in the book, Kahneman's approach to thinking fast and thinking slow and red work and blue work. And you go back to collaborate or coerce, but coercion is so much faster, man. So much faster. And as a leader, I know what's right. So I'm putting my opinion on the table first, and then we're going to vote, you know, with a great deal of bias. And
I dare you.
Yeah, that's exactly the seduction of the thing. So, but it doesn't have to. I'll give you an example. We have to make a. I got the new book. The new book's coming out. We're going to make a book buy for our company. So have a whole bunch of books on hand. The question is, how many books do we buy? We buy too many. They sit around. It's a big capital expenditure. Blah blah blah. We got to ship them twice. We don't buy enough. Then whatever. So question is, how many books are we going to buy? Now, normally you get together and say, well, hey, we got to buy books. What do you guys think? And someone starts talking. It's very kind of linear. And whatever number the first person says, group's going to be like plus or minus 2,000. Like we'll end up at 2,020 or something. So, well, here's what we did. I said, everyone take a card. And I had, what do we have? We had most of the company here. They had like eight people. And I said, write down on the card how many books you think we should buy and what your confidence level is, 0 to 5 on your number. And then everyone wrote a card and they throw it in the middle before we discussed it. And then then I looked at all the cards. We had a 0, confidence level 5. We had some numbers in between, and we had like, I think the highest number was 4,000. 4,000, so that's like 100 grand, confidence level 5. And we had numbers in between. That took exactly 30 seconds. Now I say, oh, okay, let's hear from the outlet. Let's hear from the 0. It means the safe people feel safe, I think. I mean, it's my company, of course it's safe. But
we're going to do a poll on that. We're going to ask an anonymous poll.
Yeah, we're going to ask.
We'll get you some feedback, David. Don't worry.
No, like, we're stuck, and they're going to comply with that. But so then we said, now let's hear from the outliers.
Well, there's the beauty, right? That's the beauty of collaboration. You said it before. Yeah. When you're driving for consensus, you pound that out, and you don't get the wisdom of those outliers.
There's a study, if you, at a keynote, I say, I saw someone else do this. I stole it from some researcher, but it works. I say, write down the last two digits of your phone number. Now write down the number of countries in Africa. And the people with the higher last two digits guess a higher number. People get anchored. We know it's true. Even if I say there's a psychological kind of anchor, it doesn't matter. You're still going to be vulnerable to it. So when we run a meeting like that, all we're doing is reducing variability. It's an embrace variability sport. Don't bring reduced variability playset to an embrace variability game, which is what many organizations are doing.
How do you invite dissent?
Right.
First, many things. You can run the meeting in a way that, like I said, the people write down their numbers and then you can see what's different. If it seems like everyone's agreeing, we play a card game where I pass out black, I put one or two red cards in the pack, and I deal them out. If you have a red card, you have to disagree with the group.
Regardless of how you feel. It's a bit of improv.
Regardless of how you feel. Correct. Rhetorical, and there's two things I'm looking for there. One is I want the disagreement to happen. Two, I want to see how people react to the disagreement. Do we react by being compelling and push that person back into their shell? Or do we act with honest curiosity and say, oh, tell me what you see that we're missing. Tell us how you are processing this. And there's, again, a study. This is the, they were looking, the people came in for a vision test. And there were three lines and they went around and everyone said the wrong number, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, and it was really three. Which line is the same length as the other two lines? And then a third of the people then agreed with the group even though it was wrong. Well, there was a variation on that where they had one person disagree with the group, but they said the other wrong line. So it was like, let's say the right answer is three. So they said 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2. Then we get to the last person. That broke the spell. Almost never did the person say the wrong number. It wasn't because they agreed with them. It was simply because there was a dissenting opinion. So dissent, one person dissenting, helps everybody able to feel safe enough to express.
God, humans are amazing.
They're super cool.
And they do respond, right, to stimulus and things that are positive or things that are negative. One of the things you talked about was that, you know, you get a certain level of responsiveness from fear, right? That people will achieve a certain level of production, right? Which is great because that becomes really predictable. And so you may not get explosive performance, but it's predictable. And one of the things that I have found is that there's this pressure around commitments, right? And decision-making in general. And you talk a lot about commitment versus compliance, right? And I think one of the things that I know I've used in the past is I use fear just because I feel fear, right? I'm scared and I'm worried and I sort of polish it up and I hand it to my team and I say, you know, I use words, go get it done.
Yeah, right. That cascade that fear down the organization. Everyone knows that's what to play. Yeah,
exactly. And then what ends up happening is that what it actually does is people learn how not to commit, right? They don't actually work towards the goal and the outcome. And it becomes really an interesting cultural dynamic where folks are able to obfuscate and blame other people. And I don't have any responsibility because my organization is so screwed up. Right.
Yeah.
So as a leader, as they're walking into a situation where they do feel fear, right, and they are nervous and whatnot, and they're, everything that they learned is about, okay, I'm going to drive to compliance, right? You guys are signing up for this, right? So maybe you could talk a little bit about how do we get to some kind of collaboration and commitment together? How do we set that up so that people feel like, okay, I'll give that a shot. I'm in.
Well, I'm not 100%. Since you have a good answer to that, but your story about the thing that really grabbed on that grabbed me was your story that people then develop a language that results in them of being able to avoid commitment. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen it I was in a country in Asia. And we had the intervention in country, and then we did some follow-up weekly phone calls, and they were so good. I wanted to dig my teeth into something about what happened, but they were always so good at sort of somehow saying it in a way that there really wasn't anything to hold them accountable for. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to decode how they had developed such a precise language of imprecision. But I saw it also in a very interesting place in a construction site here in the United States. And the way it worked, there would be conversations like this. The foreman would say, well, when are we going to, he would look at the concrete guy and say, hey, when are we going to start pouring concrete? That's the next phase of the project. The site's been prepared. We're going to pour concrete. It was scheduled for Wednesday. Are we going to pour concrete on Wednesday? And the concrete guy would say, well, I don't know. What if the weather's bad? And how can I don't really know. And the contractors would had all these tricks for not committing to the date. Now, at the same time, the reason they did that is because if they said, yeah, it's a binary question, which was bad. They should have said, well, give me what are the probabilities here? What's the probability you can pour on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? 10, 80, 10, whatever it is. So we're trying to make a probabilistic future, a deterministic binary future, which people will resist. And the second thing is, if the contractor did say, yeah, I think there's an 80% chance we can pour on Wednesday, and it turns out freeze came in or whatever happened, and we can't pour on Wednesday, then there'd be hell to pay. And will you promise me? He's like, no, actually I didn't. I just said 80%. And so there's bad behavior on both sides, and it's the self-reinforcing bad behavior loop, which results in that.
As a leader, then, how do you see good invitations for commitment happening? You know, what's a good invite? What's a good question that doesn't necessarily fend off the dodge, but creates the safe situation where the respondee can actually speak in a way that's direct, accurate, small enough, and discreet enough? But, you know, let's look at language.
I like saying, what's the probability of whatever. I'll have things where, let's say, I had to stay in the hospital about a year ago, and I'm asking, well, when's the lunch cart come by? And the person says, well, I don't know. And I said, oh, well, will they come by at 5 a.m? No, not that early. Will they come by at 5 p.m? Well, not that late. Okay, so you do know it's between 5 o'clock and 5 p.m. How about 6 and 4? Like, you do know something. And I give them a clock. I say, you know, draw the probability. They just looked at me sideways. Like, we do have people fall into this trap. I don't know everything, so I don't know anything. Where versus, I think I might not know everything, but I actually know a fair amount. We are uncomfortable with those ambiguous. We're wired for that's why you have so much binary language. Insider, outsider, yes, no, black, white. We have so much binary language, and we're sort of drawn into this binary thinking. We're wired for it.
Your new book has a story, another story about a ship. And it's a powerful analogy. And there's a line in there about there was a woman who knew a way to do it better, right? And things were not good. The situation was not looking great for anybody. And yet she had an idea, right? And the whole setup was binary, right? Yeah. And it used the word about, I think, a bias to overconfidence. And I think that, you know, that to me is when that's in motion, right? And it's what's funny to me is it's there, who knows where in the chain of command, so to speak, a great idea is, where there's a better idea or a new way of doing it. And when somebody has that, how do we help them raise their hand and do say, hey, I have something I want to bring up. How could we help them?
Well, a lot has to do with how we react when they do bring those things up. In this case, so the story is the Elfar, which is a container ship, 33 people on board, 2015, leaves Jacksonville, Florida, heading for San Juan, sails into a hurricane and sinks. How can that be? All 33 people died. Fortunately, the government recovered the black box, and we have a transcript over 500 pages long of what was said on the bridge of that ship. So we see them, we hear them talking about the decisions that they're going to make. And they're sailing on the Atlantic side of the Bahamas, which is where the storm is. And there's an opportunity to cut through the Bahamas. There's this halfway point where there's a channel. They can cut through and go onto the backside of the Bahamas, which is the protected side. And she's calling the captain to say, hey, we're at this point. We could divert. Now, it turns out the ship sinks 6 hours after this phone call was made. And it's just haunting and eerie as you read her words. Her words are deferential and hesitant. Well, we could if blah, blah. And you're just like, no. And you just want to say, no, speak up, be clear. But here's the key. 2 hours before that, another officer had another phone call with the captain that sounded almost exactly the same, with the same haunting, deferential, ambiguous, and ineffective language. And when you play the tape back towards the beginning, you hear things like a crewman says, we're going into the hurricane, and the captain says, wouldn't have it any other way. And there's all this sort of bluster, which, again, these weren't bad people. These are professional mariners. And this is, none of these things that these people say are things I haven't heard in the Navy, and some of which I've actually said myself. We're just in the wrong playbook. And the playbook, you can see it playing out. First, we have to obey the clock because we got to get there. This diversion will take an extra 6 hours. Number two, I'm going to coerce the team into doing these things like, oh, the ship can take it. Wouldn't have it. He mocks at one point people who would divert. And he gives sort of a mocking, oh, my gosh, and sort of a high-pitched voice on the tape. Now, and then his officers now, 12 hours later, have to call him and say, oh, by the way, I'm that high-pitched mocking voice. The person that you mocked, now I've become, because I think we need to divert. Interestingly enough, the captain never refers to the hurricane with the word hurricane. He called it a storm, a low pressure, a weather system. He never calls it a hurricane. And it's been classified as a category one, two, and then three. Category, it was a category three hurricane. And the language is so interesting. And I was really very sensitive about using it because all these people die. And it's very easy to be critical. I think this misses the point.
Right.
They're good people, professional mariners, trying to do the right thing, but they're just equipped with the wrong playbook. And it's so clear when I read it. And this is, and then at the end of the book, I reimagine the world in which, with the correct playbook, they all live. And to me, I hope that gives solace to the people, the family members of the people who lost their lives. I think it can be helpful for the rest of us to avoid similar fates.
Yeah. Some of the plays that you described out of that are pretty powerful and apply in the software or the knowledge business. Don't commit to the annual plan. Don't commit to the quarterly plan, right? Commit to learning.
Yeah.
Not just doing, which ties into your improved play. And chunk it small.
Yeah.
And make it through all layers of the cake that you're not just shipping components that don't work, but and then tying it into controlling the clock where you test your assumptions quickly, cheaply.
Yeah, you can see the influence of the Agile movement on the writing. Because I'd be giving speeches at Agile events and be working on the book, and then I'd be talking to people, guys like you, and they'd be saying, well, yeah, we would handle it this way. We think about it like this. And I'm like, yeah, that's genius.
Yeah, so there's an influence there. But and from the other direction, and I'm speaking for Eric because we talked a little bit, the focus on language takes it beyond the team level,
yeah,
and brings it into the system and the organization where large-scale changes have to happen to enable the team to work as powerfully as they can.
Right.
Right? So it's we're feeding on each other here, which is really powerful.
Yeah. So an interesting thing happened as I was getting near the end of what I thought was the end, which was only the halfway point, working on the book. And I started thinking about this idea of reflection and doing in my life. And yeah, you know what? I think my life is following the same pattern in that as a youngster, I go to school. So that's a period of blue work, learning. And then I'm launched into the world with this sort of semi-expectation of now I'm going to go to work for the next 60, whatever it is. So it's like one shot of blue followed by unending doing. And then I started thinking about like Bill Gates and his Think Weeks. And I think that's what he's trying to do. He's like, I got to inject a pause and reflect into this constant doing, or I'm never going to be sharpening the saw. And it's the same thing with Stephen Covey's thing. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, well, geez, maybe it's time for me in my life to do a sabbatical or go back to school or be deliberate about what I'm doing. I think it'd be easy for me to just keep doing what I'm doing because I'm doing it and it's fun. I mean, there's probably nothing wrong with it, but I'm not sure that I need to shouldn't control my own clock and do a little bit of pause and reflect my life.
This is a good segue into the fourth play, which is don't just continue. Complete something.
Yeah.
Right? Don't just keep repeating. Celebrate what you've accomplished and then focus on what's the next leg of the journey.
Yeah. I got a pretty good stop at three. I don't know about you.
Okay, so we got five more minutes. Improve, don't prove. Give us a quick overview of that.
So here's the problem of the way I see it. In the old way, we didn't need people to reflect upon their own work because we would stand behind them with clipboards and we would judge them.
Yeah.
But now, if I want the doers to be the deciders, I need to say, pause, team, what do you think? Could we have done that better? How could we have done that better? This puts the two identities that you have, which I call the be good self and the get better self. The be good self is the person who wants to be, I want to feel competent in life. I want to feel worthy. I want to feel like I earned my salary. And then there's the be good, the get better self. The get better self is this self that gets excited about seeing a fork in the road that they haven't taken before. The exploring, seeking, discovery part of life. But the be good self gets in the way of the get better. The behaviors of the be good self get in the way of the behaviors of the get better self. The be good self, when someone comes up and says, to me at the end of a keynote and says, can I give you some feedback? Which, by the way, was a terrible way to say it, but can I give you some feedback? At that moment, my be good self rises up. And that protective shell comes out. I was like, what do you know? I just want, you know, I give them 500 keynotes. How many have you done? Blah, blah, blah. And that's not helpful. So, but then the get better self, if I contain the be good self, then the get better self comes and says, oh, yeah, tell me what you see. Tell me what you thought.
Yeah, a little tip for the listeners. Don't do that at the end of anybody's keynote, please. can I buy you a beer? Yeah. Do you want a cup of coffee? Here's my hip flask.
Right. So the idea is if we want our teams to evaluate their own work, their own decisions, things that they've been a part of, that they've invested their life in, then we need to tame that be good self and activate the get better self. That comes from allowing people to feel safe. It's an issue of safety. I always thought, well, we're just going to provoke people into improving, which isn't the right approach. It's a sense of safety. It's care to dare. George Kollreiser has this, right? We have to have a sense of caring and feel secure in our base in order to venture out. There was a study where mice had two tunnels. They had these little mice and they had two tunnels that could go down. One was sort of interesting but scary. The other one was boring but safe. When their mothers were there, the mice were more likely to go down to the interesting but scary tube. When the mothers weren't there, they went down the boring but safe tube. The presence of the mothers making them feel safe allowed them to be more risk embracing.
How does it tie into organizations and hierarchies? I'm trying to figure out if mice have the equivalent of, you know, layers of leadership in their clan. But your last bit is, you know, connect, don't conform, right, which talks about hierarchies and people connecting at all levels, which requires a great deal of safety as an antidote to fear.
In the industrial age, I didn't need my workforce to make decisions. I didn't care. I made the decisions for them. Now, if I'm going to say, well, you have to evaluate, you're going to be part of the decision-making apparatus. But here's the thing. Decisions, this is basically the way it works. Your decision processing flows through an emotional part of your brain before it becomes output. Healthy emotions are necessary for healthy decision-making, and feeling connected like a human is necessary for healthy emotions. In the past, I didn't care whether you had a healthy emotional life because I never was asking you to make decisions. For you to sit at a stool, do the same simple physical repeated task 8.5 hours a day, your emotional life could be crap and it didn't really matter. But now it matters a lot. If I wanted to tame that be good self, activate the get better self, and allow people to dispassionately look back and say, yeah, you know what, we gave it our all, but there are things we can do better next time.
I want to respect your time, sir, and say thank you so much for spending this hour with you. You got any gigs coming up in February and March that you want to shout out before we close out the show?
Yeah, well, the book's launching, Leadership is Language. I really hope that it helps you in a couple different ways. It's going to give you some very tactical ways to say things, and it's framed within the structure that we talked about. I'm really excited about hearing from you and what you try, what works, what doesn't work. Sharing, let me celebrate with you the successes you have in your life.
Great. What are the best ways for people to get in touch with you?
David at Turn the Ship Around is my email. I'm on LinkedIn. L. David Marquet on most social media platforms. Yep. And if you go to my website, there's a little block, contact us, click, tell my story. Hey, this is what we did. Everyone got healthier, prettier, richer.
And happier.
And happier. Yeah, that's I was missing that one.
Well, thanks again to both of you, David Marquet and Eric Cottrell, and to our listening audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review, a rating, or leave a comment. Subscribe if this is your first time. And if you want to join the discussion, share your stories about abandoning the old command and control language that we've gotten from Taylor and Gantt in the old industrial era, and how it's dramatically improved your decision-making and the happiness in your team, especially when it comes to choosing the right craft beer to have on tap in the team room.
Noted.
Join us at coalition.agileuprising.com. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.